had to have a Storm Sour Roe because I knew that if I had a Storm Sour Roe, it would firstly reinvigorate the street.
Yeah.
But more than that, I mean, you know, Sour Roe really is a heartbeat of a lot of values of what it is to be British. And so if I could go there and have an influence of that, then I could change perceptions.
Welcome to House Guest with me, Carol Annett, where I chat to people who shape the world around us through decoration and design. My final house guest for this year is the fashion designer Oswald Boateng, who's had a transformational impact on menswear fashion for almost three decades. He's now dipping his toe into interiors. I caught up with Oswald in late September at the Poltrona Frau showroom. This morning, I'm very excited to say that I'm sitting with Oswald Boateng, OBE, in the Poltrona Frau showroom on the Fulham Road in London. Oswald, I'm sure, will be known to so many of you as the English fashion designer of Ghanaian heritage, renowned for his trademark twist on classic tailoring, hence why we are at Poltrona Frau, where actually it's the coming together of two tailors. Although you're obviously a menswear designer,
yeah.
Poltrona Frau is a heritage furniture brand,
yes.
And yet there's the tailoring that's brought you together.
What's brought us together is our understanding of tradition and our willingness to look at ways of evolving tradition. I think the collaboration really is that. You know, Poltrona have this amazing handling of quality, right? You know, one of the funniest things when we, I keep saying this, I feel it's almost coming like a mantra. It's becoming the running joke between myself and Nicola. But early in the relationship, when we started discussing about what we're going to do, because I'm all about execution, so quality of make and understanding the construction is really important to me. So I went to the factory to see how they make these chairs. So I was looking and I saw the way they kind of molded the leather and sculpted the leather around the frame of the Chester.
And the Chester is one of their very
iconic pieces.
Iconic pieces.
Yeah. So, you know, when we started again, we looked at how are we choosing to start our collaboration. And I've always had a relationship with the Chester. This is something like in my early career, you know, I was a photographer for magazines, you know, I'd be sitting in effectively this chair. So there was a relationship already. So I immediately gravitated towards it as soon as I saw it as part of the collection. So that it was very clear that that needed to be done. But what really excited me, because again, when you're come from an Italian background, you're all about the quality of finish. It's all about execution. They have this machine which tests the amount of times that you actually sit on the chair. So sounds interesting, but it's 100,000 impressions. So I'm like, 100,000 times? 100,000. So we had a lovely dinner last night and one of my friends is really good at numbers. And I sort of said to him, he says, oh, that's three times a day for 100 years. So I'm like, that sort of sums up the attention to detail and quality. So that was one of the things I did not have to worry about in this relationship. You know, it then it gave me the freedom just to be creative and know that the execution, regardless of the idea, will be executed brilliantly.
And tell me a little bit about the pattern. Is this a signature pattern?
Yes.
And this is a sort of, it's got elements of tribal.
Yeah, so we call it the tribal pattern. And it's a design that I've been using quite a while in my work, and you can see it in my clothing. But I've always looked at a lot of my designs and fabrics that could easily translate to many other things. And so it was a great way to start to take this iconic piece of Poltrona with this distinct look that everyone who knows my work knows is my design and blend the two worlds together. But again, it's always about not shouting about the design. So it's obvious and yet not. So if you look at it, it's more or less adding a texture to the experience. Then it's, okay, this is an obvious pattern. On the Vanity Fair, again, it's also doing the same thing. You can see it quite distinct, but again, there's a subtlety to it.
So the Vanity Fair is an armchair.
Yes.
And you've put the same pattern, but in a larger scale on a beautiful velvet.
Absolutely. And so this is the marriage between the Chester and the Vanity Fair is because I was just drawn to these iconic pieces within their collection. And it just made sense to reinterpret these pieces. And in fact, we know I don't think we even had much discussion about it. We just both knew that's what needed to be done. And then it became about experimentation on what materials we could use on the chest and on the vanity fair. And so, in fact, I remember the first day when I'd given sort of like the creative brief on, you know, the ideas. And there was a lot of ideas and they welcomed it. And so I came in, it was a room full of all these different variables of my tribal print and my kente print. And it was great. So I was like a kid in a candy shop going, I want this, I want great. Can I have everything? And of course, you know, they show you everything. Then they sort of like, you can't have everything. You can have just this. So we finally went from a very large opportunity to a smaller opportunity. But still, what I love most about the collaboration is that we've got a language that we've created together that is distinct and it's working effortlessly. You know, it's not, we're trying to make it work. It just works.
So can we sort of rewind a bit and go back to your roots and how you got to Savile Row and your career? So you're born in Muswell Hill.
Yeah, I'm born in North London, Crouch End, Archway, Muswell Hill. Yeah, I was brought up in Muswell Hill, yes.
So I read that your mum had given you a double-breasted purple mohair suit aged 8.
Five. So I was five. I was 5 years old.
You must have looked so dapper.
No, it's interesting because 30 years ago, I was looking at a picture. I somehow discovered a picture that my mother had, and I look at it, and I'm seeing myself in this purple mohair suit, and it's double-breasted. And if you know anything about my brand, purple became a really distinct color in all the collections I've created. And so...
And there's a purple armchair.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. So it's very much a part of my identity, right?
Yeah.
And so I look and I go, that's crazy. And I remember when I looked at the picture, I remember my mum having that suit made for me. And mohair became a material that I became really known for using. So there's this weird always, I think, when you look at your past in your life, there's always these little signals or breadcrumbs that actually finding your destination, right? So that was a real kind of wow moment for me.
And so were your parents particularly creative? And where did you get that kind of passion for, other than sort of wearing the clothes?
The thing is my mum needs to make clothes at home and, you know, kind of like piecework. So, you know, someone gives you some cut pieces and you're sewing together and you put them back to the factory. And I remember distinctly going, I will never do that. I will have nothing to do with clothes. This is like, I'm never going to do this job. And my dad was an academic, you know, so he was like, no, you study, you get a really good job, you know, doctor, lawyer. So his creativity to him was like, that's a hobby, that's not serious. So, you know, I completely rejected this as a path, but there was always sewing machines in the house. And then how I got into fashion was through a girlfriend I was seeing at college while I was studying computer programming. Back in the day, early 80s, 0011. I usually say, because usually interviewers are so much younger, right? So they don't understand what I say, when I say basic. But I'm hoping that you get what I'm talking about.
I get what you're saying.
Because the basic is like, anyway, it's like the beginning of the whole computer program revolution. I was like, you know, learning to become a programmer. And my girlfriend at the time said, well, I'm doing a fashion show. You know, she was incredibly creative, you know, paint, draw, everything. And she said, look, help me design this collection. I was like, I can't do this. Now, the reality of it is, because I'd always been rejecting my mother's machine and making clothes, the truth was, 2 summers prior to this, I'd lied about my age. And my mother had said to me that you need to get a summer job. And I ended up in a factory sewing clothes. And I basically said I could sew and I couldn't. And so they basically taught me.
Bullshit gets you everywhere.
Right. So I was really young. I should never have been there. And I did it for 2 summers. So obviously I knew how to use a machine. And obviously really well. But of course I had rejected this thing as a part of my life. So then my girlfriend comes and she says, oh, you know, could you help me design? I said, oh, well, I can't really do it. And then she gets to my house, it's a sewing machine, and we're sewing. She goes, God, you're natural. And so, you know, we made the collection, and then to my surprise, what we created, people wanted to buy it.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm 16 years old, and I think, what, really, you're interested in what I'm creating?
Yeah.
And so it started from there.
And then you were mentored by Tommy Nutter.
Yeah, interesting. So I then, I sort of discovered that it's calling me, this designing. And then a friend of mine was a researcher for a TV show. And he said, look, why don't you come on this show? You might meet some people, famous people who like maybe to buy your clothes, you know. And that time I was kind of making it to order. And, you know, at this point I'm like 17. And I go on that show and then I start meeting all these famous people. And so it became normal to dress famous people for clothing. So you, when you're that young, you don't know what it is.
Yeah.
And you almost take it all for granted. And so before I knew it, I was in the business. And then I decided that maybe I should learn a little bit. So I went to college to study a bit of fashion. But again, I was already in it. And so by the time I was 18, I was starting to get some momentum. I mean, the world is very different place then, you know, this is the 80s. But if you got a little piece in a fashion magazine those days, it meant a lot. Mm. And those days it was ID magazine and The Face. This is like, yeah. And there was a movement called Buffalo, which photography, which was very inclusive. So I felt, because Frudo photography was shooting men in a very particular way, which was, you know, we have all this language about non-binary and all the rest of it. But in this, it was like, you could be a man wearing a skirt and be you and it all be okay. So it was all about the energy and the vibe of the individual as opposed to anything else. So you look like didn't matter.
Yeah.
So this really influenced me and encouraged me to really take this fashion really seriously, because I felt that I could see an opportunity.
Yeah. You showed in Paris, you were one of the first.
I showed in Paris. So the journey is very much, in the 80s, sort of understood the opportunity. And then also going to Savile Row, meeting Tommy Nutter. Tommy Nutter was an amazing tailor. He was really not a tailor. He was a designer, actually.
Yeah.
But he didn't define himself as such.
So do you call yourself a tailor or a designer?
So this is the interesting point. So I go to Savile Row, I'm 18 years old, and I'm in front of Tommy Nutter's window. And he comes out, he sees me, I'm wearing a suit, you know, really tailored suit. Asked me where you got it, so I said I made it, because I'm 18, so I'm overly confident. And he says, no, come here, I want to show you something. So I go into his store and he shows me the way, the traditional way of making suits, brutally handcrafted. And then I look in his window and I'm thinking, you're more than just a tailor, because he had used really interesting fabrics, really innovative. And that's not what I understood Savile Row to be. So he was very unique in that. But when I asked him, and I sort of said to him, you're more than a tailor, he didn't accept that. He said, yeah. I'm a tailor. So then I realized the opportunity, and the opportunity spoke loud to me that if I could combine fashion with traditional tailoring, I could create something very unique. So at that point, I was 18, and it took me, I think, 8 years from that point before I finally opened my store in Savile Row. And part of that journey of opening the store in Savile Row was tailoring wasn't very fashionable at that time. It was really a dying concept.
Yeah.
And so what I realized was the way to revitalize the focus around tailoring was to do a catwalk show in Paris. And in those days, because it's the early 90s, you had Vivienne Westwood and Paul Smith showing in Paris from the UK. And it was a big step for anyone British to go to Paris, because it was like the main stage, right? And they were backed by big Japanese deals that had, and I was self-financing. So the whole thing was nuts. And everyone was like, you're crazy, you're going to go to Paris. But anyway, I had started to build a bit of a profile in a few fashion magazines. I was covered in Vogue and GQ, because what I was bringing was very unique. And my communication around it was clear. It was all about classics with a twist, modernizing tradition. So the language was speaking. And then I talked about the power of a handmade suit, but basically the tailors are couturiers, and I was making that comparison.
Yeah.
So the story behind my creations, what really started to galvanize interests. I got a lot of media. And then I was able to carry that to my first show. And then I've always been quite creative in my presentation. So I had a mate of mine who was an amazing musician who was really famous in France at the time perform. And I made my invitation to the show was a short film, which, you know, was basically I posted out VHS cassettes to all the guests.
And VHS. Everyone,
yes, exactly. VHS. Exactly. You had to put it into your recorder machine to know where you had to go. This is how early it is. So that really sort of got a lot of support. And so as a consequence, the show went really well and loads of opportunities came off the back of it. And that was the start. And on that journey of getting that recognition, I understood that I had to have a Storm Sour Row because I knew that if I had a Storm Sour Row, it would firstly reinvigorate the street.
Yeah.
But more than that, reinvigorate. I mean, you know, Sour Row really is a heartbeat of a lot of values of what it is to be British. And so if I could go there and have an influence of that, then I could change perceptions. Because I grew up at a time in the 70s where racism was a norm, early 80s race riots. So I experienced all that. There was a law called a sus law where you get stopped in the street and they could, you know, the police could stop it anytime into your pocket. So I grew up with all of that. So the key for me was always to change the perception of what it is to be someone of color, right? And so that was also an underlying driving factor of why I set up in Sour Row. It was a commercial, those days, Covent Garden was a much better option, open opposite Paul Smith, but I chose Sour Row.
It's a really interesting to realize the kind of decision because, you know, he was doing the cool funky stuff in a way and you were kind of, no, I'm gonna be in the traditional tailoring area and I'm going to bring the cool funky stuff to that.
Yes, absolutely. Also, I knew the implications of me being there. I knew that it would inspire. I mean, I grew up not many known black faces on TV. There was like Muhammad Ali, Michael Jackson.
Frank Bruno.
No, he came again later.
Really?
I mean, you're talking about, you know, growing up in the 70s. So, I mean, you know, 70s where you're a kid, you're looking, you're trying to figure out what you're going to do in your life, right? The 70s, 80s, there was not a lot. It was quite literally Muhammad Ali when he was fighting and then Michael Jackson and then... And then Nelson Mandela, who was in prison, trying to get out of prison. So there was not a lot of role models. So I've always thought about how do I shift perceptions with what I do. And yeah. So, you know, if I can break through perceptions with what I do, then it'll help change perspectives. Because, you know, in the old days when I'd do an interview and we'd talk about these things, I would never discuss my upbringing. I would never discuss the dynamics of what I experienced because I never wanted it to be a barrier to what I wanted to create and what I wanted to achieve. And by communicating, I experienced all these things, we're almost saying, oh, because I've experienced this, I can't achieve what I'm planning to achieve. So I didn't want to have any barriers. So the way I dealt with it was never to acknowledge it.
Yeah.
I just basically talked about the work. I talked about the contribution because the thing is, and this is the other very important point, is Sour Row as a street was dying before I moved, right?
Yeah.
And so this is a big institution. If you think of the history of the people who've been dressed on that street, there's a lot of core value system in that street. And so the thing is I was basically saying, I believe and I respect the tradition of this street. And I understand it, and I'm going to breathe new life into it, but I'm going to do it as me.
Yeah.
And so by showing respect to that tradition, hopefully you can respect people who don't look like you. Because if they're going to respect your traditions, then you should also respect their traditions. So this is the subliminal messaging that I was having. And I knew this very early on. So from the time I was 18, I knew what I had to do because of my background.
Yeah, no, it's fascinating. It really is. And it also what shines through is your bravery in your decision making because you really kind of put yourself out there.
Oh, yeah.
Tell me about British Airways. When did you redesign the uniforms?
So British Airways was interesting because, again, you know, I never do a collaboration without a why. And so there's always a reason. And if I can't see the why, I won't do it. And what was interesting for me is, again, British Airways, like Sour Row, represents Britain. And I think right in this moment, what it is to be British has evolved and changed so much. And so with this collaboration, I wanted to kind of demonstrate what it means to be British now.
When did you get on board with the BA?
No, we started the project about 5 years ago, maybe even longer now, maybe 6 years, but it was supposed to be launched 3 years ago, but COVID, it kind of put everything back. So
you're still working with them?
Yeah, we're launching now. But there was two parts to that project. I think part one was I fly BA, right? And so one of the things I felt was really important in this collaboration is I wanted to give the staff choice and I wanted them to feel that they had a voice in the decision of what this uniform looked like. And so I took on myself to really engage with them. That's the first thing. The second thing was I had basically the option just to dress above the wing, which is just the hair stewards and the pilots, which was the first offer. But I basically said, look, I think I need to dress everybody. And that's the baggage handler, you know, the engineer. And initially they were quite surprised how I would be willing to do that. And I said, well, I want it because I think if I can create something that your staff feel good in, then I think it's going to have huge impact on your business. So that's basically what I did. So I went to see the engineers and the baggage handlers and yeah, I actually went to see them and talked to them about what they would want. And then I created it. Yeah. And so I'm not responsible for making the pieces. It's just about me creating. But I gave really good, I think, I would say strategic advice to BA about how they should approach it. But I think as a whole, I think the staff are happy with what has been done for them. So
exciting. Thank you very much, Oswald. It's been really, really lovely to meet you. And congratulations on the Poltrona Frau. It is exceptional. Yeah. And I'm delighted that you're wearing a green suit to match your green
furniture. I didn't actually think about it in that context. But there you go. My pleasure.
It's good to meet you.
Pleasure.
Thank you for joining me today. You can hear more Houseguest on British Airways In-Flight Entertainment in the audio section, along with our sister podcast, Breakout Culture, with Lord Edvasey and Charlotte Metcalf. You can follow me on Instagram at Carol W. Annett.